Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. For this episode, we're looking at compulsory voting in Australia. Is it a right or a duty? Our guests Judith Brett and Kim Rubenstein join host Sally Warhaft to discuss how the system has changed and how it'll change in the future.
I think it was Michelle Obama who said, when they go low, we go high. And while these blokes during this election campaign are out there telling their fuzzies and their porkies and accusing each other of God knows what, we thought we might have a bit of a deeper look at some of the things that underpin our democracy. Our compulsory voting, but also the other things that make our democracy distinctive. So it's a unusually positive Fifth Estate, I think, tonight in some ways, because I'm feeling very uplifted by a lot of the reading that I've done. It's such a pleasure to have Judith Brett back here as a guest. She's an award-winning author, emeritus professor of politics at La Trobe University, and her books include Robert Menzies' Forgotten People and the wonderful enigmatic Mr. Deacon. But her latest book is From Secret Ballot to Democracy Sausage, How Australia Got Compulsory Voting. And it's a must-read in the lead-up to the election, and it'll be on sale with Dimmicks at the end of this evening's conversation. Also joining us is Kim Rubenstein. She's the author of the landmark book Australian Citizenship Law in Context, which was updated and republished in 2017. She's a professor in the law school at the ANU, a former director of its Centre for International and Public Law, and a public policy fellow. Please give them both a warm Wheeler welcome. I'm going to start with a question, which is, Judy's got it in her book, and I also know this from my past life at La Trobe, that she used to start often her courses by asking first-year students what their earliest political memory is. And so I'm going to put it to each of you this evening out of great curiosity. Judy, what's yours?
Well, I was born in 1949, so my first political memories are in the 50s, and I was in a sort of Labor voting household. I think my mother didn't always vote Labor, but my father did. And so all through the 50s, there was just a sense of gloom at election times, is what I remember, that, you know, we'd lost again and it sort of wasn't fair. And I was pretty small, and I think it was that the newspapers, the media was a bit stacked against Labor. That's what I took away from that. So it wasn't really until 1972 that things started to look up.
Kim, what's yours?
So mine is actually a high school memory. And when you say political memory, it takes me straight back to year 10 at Presbyterian Ladies College, Melbourne, where Pat Smith, who was my politics teacher, so year 10 was actually 1980, so it was before I could vote, but she really made an impression upon us because she got us to, during that year, to run our own election. And the story is one that has stayed with me for the rest of my life, because each classroom was an electorate and I became the leader of the United Australia Party and campaigned, and we even had a TV channel at the school, and I had to give my campaign speech, and we had the vote. And the United Australia Party won. But there was one problem. I'd lost my own seat. So I have used that as an instruction for the rest of my life. If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? But if I'm only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? So that was my first political
memory.
Well,
they're great memories. They're probably unusual in a sense, and it's not surprising since the career trajectories that you both took, because I would imagine for most people it's an early memory of going to vote.
Well, that's certainly the case when I used to ask it of students. It was either of going to the polling booth or perhaps watching the election results on the television. But mine was sort of hazy. I can't remember going to a polling booth with my parents, which puzzles me.
It's, of course, you know, described in the book as this affront to our freedom, this idea that we're forced to go and do this thing of voting. It's rare, of course. Just give us a little quick, I suppose, summary, Judy, of how this came about.
Well, I think, Sally, Australians on the whole never felt that it was an affront to their freedom. I think, you know, there's always a few people who will say, oh, you know, you can't be a democracy if you force people to vote. But most Australians thought that it was a good idea because we were what I call majoritarian Democrats. That is, people thought that it gave the government greater legitimacy if it was elected by the majority of the electorate. And so that idea was around really from the end of the 19th century. The problems were mainly practical. How much should people be fined for not voting? How would you know? You know, everybody will just make excuses, say they are sick. How would you know whether they were lying? You know, they were those sort of practical problems. And there was also neither side of politics really knew which side this would advantage. For a while, the Conservatives thought it would advantage them because they thought that that the more radical working class people would vote, and that the unions were well organised, so the working class vote would be well organised, whereas the middle class vote would be disorganised, and they'd be busy running their businesses or their farms and wouldn't get around to voting. So it was first introduced, in fact, by a Conservative Queensland government, and then Labor won the election. So Labor then thought, oh, maybe this is a good idea. So by the time it's introduced in 1924, and then also happening quite soon before that is the conscription referendum, which, you know, were very bitterly fought. But that was about the state having the right to compel people, to conscript people in order to send them to fight. So by the time 1924 comes, when a private members' bill is introduced, the sorts of people who you might have thought would argue against compulsory voting on the basis of, say, freedom of conscience or liberty or whatever, had just spent, you know, 3 years arguing for the state's right to compel you to vote. To compel you to kill someone. So that being the case, there wasn't really any strong feeling against it.
The truth seems to be that compulsory voting's benefited different parties at different times. First of all, is that sort of true? Is that a fair reading?
Well, no, I think that probably it benefits... I think it's benefited the Country Party, National Party, and I think it's benefited the Labor Party, because what political science, you know, now surveys done on people's political behaviour and on voting, know is that the people less likely to vote when voting's voluntary are people who are poorer, less well educated, more marginalised, for whom it's more difficult to get to a polling booth, or who just have very little interest. So it's probably benefits parties to the left.
Hmm. Kim, all of this is about, you know, what it means to be a citizen in this country. And there's a quote in the book: the Australians viewed citizenship as a status conferred on them by government. What does that mean?
I think it's a really interesting part of the book, Judith, in terms of that period. I think we're talking, you're writing here when you write that in the early 1900s. And what is fascinating is there was actually no legal status of citizenship at that time. So this idea of citizenship was encompassed in the notion of being a British subject. And one of the real anomalies about voting still to this very day is that British subjects who were on the electoral roll until 1984 are still able to be on the electoral roll because they were enrolled at a time when being a British subject was sufficient to be an active citizen, even though they weren't formal citizens. And it was only in 1949 that the actual status occurred. So I think that's interesting on one level in terms of our conception of active citizenship having been there before we were actually formal citizens. But I think the point that Judith makes powerfully about it being a top-down notion comes more with the notion of being a British subject in the sense of being subject to the power of the state or the crown. And one of the things I've argued in my writing is that that change in 1949 to citizenship status as opposed to British subject, or actually alongside British subject status, it's another story that's quite interesting, but we were both British subjects and Australian citizens for that period where those British subjects are able to be on the electoral roll, that that was the beginning of a shift of our consciousness of the rule of law being fundamental, that government is also bound by law in the way that we as individuals are, which is a more equal status, so that as becoming a citizen, you become more equal. And if you think about that in today's terms, about how citizenship has evolved, I think that we've seen a reversion to that top-down rather than equal status with some of the issues like the stripping of citizenship, and that might be another form of discussion.
I had a similar reading of that too. Judy, would you agree with that, that there sort of feels like there's that relationship today that somehow citizenship is granted, you know, it's conferred on you?
What I was trying to get at in that is that I remember... To people in the United States, the idea that you're compelled to vote has a sort of a logical contradiction, because their understanding of the state is that natural rights-bearing citizens, if you like, get together and give up some of their rights and create the state, and then the state goes about making laws and that sort of thing. So it's a logical contradiction for the state to actually order you to vote. But in British constitutional history and in the ideas that the settlers came to Australia with, I argue that Jeremy Bentham was more important than John Locke, who's the sort of social contract theorist that provides the sort of philosophical foundation for the state in the United States, said that without the state there is no law. That is, that we formed our political culture where there was already in existence a constitutional government of some sort, and so that's what I was getting at. So we don't see any problem with the state telling us to vote, because the state's sort of always been there in terms of Australian history. But I do think that in the last, well, really probably decade, perhaps more, the concept of citizenship has become nastier. It's taken on a harder, nastier edge and more exclusionary. And I think that's really to do with the way the coalition government in particular has wielded it. The idea that, you know, there should be tests for people to be able to be citizens, and the way it's linked with the uneasy debate about national identity. That's why one of the only sort of suggestion that I make in the book for reform of our voting system is that we could extend voting rights to permanent residents, and that would somehow soften it. You know, in the wake of Christchurch, I think, you know, it's clear that there's needs to be more positive work to integrate people who are newcomers to the country and who've been living here for a long time. And that would be one way I felt of sort of somehow softening it, because I feel now as if when I hear the word citizen, I cringe a bit.
Can I just add there, because there is a sort of constitutional foundation to that too. The theme of my book is about how citizenship as a legal status has the foundation of being an exclusionary status, whereas when we think about citizenship in a normative sense, we do think about active citizenship, about positive participation. But right from the start in our Australian constitutional system, there was this disjuncture. In fact, the framers of the Constitution did discuss whether they would include for the Commonwealth a power over citizenship. And Sir Isaac Isaac said, no, it will lead us to innumerable difficulties, because it means that we have to spell out those British subjects who we don't want to be coming into Australia, being the non-white British subjects,
the Indians
and those from Hong Kong, for instance. And there was the Indigenous issue. And I think this is the other point which is really interesting about Australia, that points out the sort of formality and exclusive nature of the status, Indigenous Australians were British subjects right from the start because birth in territory meant that you were a subject of the Crown, and in 1949 they became Australian citizens, but they weren't given any of the rights. In fact, it wasn't until 1962 that they were enabled on the Electoral Act, save for some of the Indigenous women in South Australia who had the right to vote and then lost it. So there's always been this tension between a legal status and then the rights that flow from it. And I think our active citizenship model is a much, obviously, more positive model. But when the state comes in and starts using citizenship as a form of nastiness, we're reminded of those foundations that have enabled it to do that. Mm.
A lot of people worked really carefully on these laws and ideas in a way that it just seems impossible to imagine a group of people now sitting down and achieving, well, pretty much anything, actually, but let alone...
We live in hope, Sally. We live in hope.
You've got probably more hope than me, Judy, but we'll see. I mean, I'm just staggered when I think of... I mean, for all the terrible problems that still exist, that, you know, of Indigenous people and women particularly, but they got a hell of a lot right, and they achieved things that are unimaginable.
Yeah, that's true.
Federation being one, but the other one being our voting system. And when you read the sort of whole story and really think about it, the thing that strikes me is that it was as if the endeavour was just to make it as easy as possible for Australians to vote, to have their say. And I hadn't realised quite how easy until you get into some of the detail. I'd always known that Saturday voting, for example, is obviously designed to have as many people as possible be able to partake. But the fact that we can vote anywhere we like...
In our state.
Yeah. Or overseas, we can go to a consulate or an embassy. We can still vote if we're interstate. Can you vote interstate?
There's various absentee places that you turn up, and there's sometimes for a while they were a different type of vote. But and I found that really interesting. That was something I didn't know till I started doing the work on this. That from right at the beginning of the 20th century, you didn't have to go to a polling booth, like in England. You are registered to a polling booth and that's where you turn up to vote, and the same in Ireland. And if you can't get there, you can use a proxy, which is, according to our ideas about secret voting, a little dubious, or you can apply for a postal vote. But if your train happens to be late or somebody invites you out for dinner and you're working in London and you don't want to go home to Brighton, well, that's you won't be able to vote. And Labor pushed that because... they'd spent an enormous amount of effort in the 1880s and 1890s enrolling the rural male workforce in the unions, you know, the shearers and drovers and rouseabouts and bullock drivers and things, and they wanted these guys to be able to vote. So that it was the early strength of the Labor Party, really, that I think explains some of this ease.
This was an issue for Brexit, wasn't it, that if you were sort of, you know... around in London, but you lived in Stoke-on-Trent and couldn't get back to give your Brexit vote. I mean, it's
and also there's some incredibly moving photos when the abortion referendum in Ireland. I wanted to put it in the book, but it was going to cost. I mean, it was a bit of an aside, but of these young women who would have once been on the boats going to get abortions. Going to Liverpool from Ireland, women of that age in their early 20s lined up with their little suitcases coming back to vote.
You talk about the ease of voting, but we also should remember that there have been various more conservative governments over the time who have sought to close the electoral roll as quickly as they can to effectively disenfranchise those people who are less likely to vote conservatively, being young people, newly naturalised Australians or people who move. And there's a very interesting case that links into some of this work. In 1983, when I was actually on a gap year, so 1983 would have been the first year that I could have voted, and Malcolm Fraser called a very quick election and closed the electoral rolls within 24 hours. And there were a group of people in New South Wales who thought, can we get around this? Because in Section 41 of the Constitution, it says no adult person who has the right to vote in any of the states can be precluded from voting in a Commonwealth election. And, of course, that section is there because of the women who Judith writes about in South Australia who said to their representatives, we will not support federation if we're going to lose our vote. So that was there. And there was a challenge to the... effectively what a group of people in New South Wales did is they got onto the electoral roll in New South Wales, even though the Commonwealth electoral rolls had closed, to say, well, we have to be enrolled because of Section 41 of the Constitution. Interestingly, and this is where courts can be err on the side of exclusion rather than inclusion, the courts looked to that history and said, well, that was specifically there to enable those women who did have the right to vote at the time. But by 1902, when the Commonwealth Electoral Act was introduced, which enfranchised, we should note, white women, not Indigenous women, those women had their right to vote protected. And so from 1902, Section 41 has no relevance and no import any further. And so that was the end. By using that history, that was the end of the value of those women's campaign, which, of course, adds a whole other story, I think, in terms of the way we use law as a tool for further, you know, representation.
I'm pretty sure that when Scott Morrison called the election last week, there were 600,000 eligible Australians who haven't yet enrolled, and they have until Thursday this week to do it. So tell them.
Absolutely.
It's really fun, right? Just enrol, vote, eat a sausage, done. Yeah. But it makes me also wonder, how could we make it even easier to vote? What else could we do?
Well, in terms of the most active form of citizenship, if you didn't actually have to go out to get your sausage and you could vote from your computer...
Oh, I think that's a terrible idea.
Well, but...
really terrible.
So do I, but I suspect it's a bit democratic.
And the notion of the technological impact, not only on our own vote, but also representation in Parliament, which is the other level of active citizenship that we might possibly talk about in Section 44 of the Constitution, because we have such a broad... voting population, but we narrow who's actually able to represent us. We're not precluding dual citizens from their voting rights. So I think
we will
really
talk about that.
I think it's a really terrible idea, electronic voting, because I do think that the rituals around election day are important. I mean that voting is not just about you sitting at your computer putting like, you know. It's about making a judgment about not just your own interests but the general public interest. And there's something about turning up at the local school or the kindergarten hall or whatever and seeing this motley collection of people, many of whom you don't really like or whatever, who've all got a right the same as you. I think that public aspect of it is really good. Now, that's already slightly diluted by the availability of pre-poll voting and the fact that people are doing that, but you still turn up, you still fill in a bit of paper, you deal with a polling clerk. So I think that the idea that it's just you and your computer would be a terrible loss.
It does remind us, though, it's the mainstream or majority who have the access to go to those polls. If you're an observant Jew, you wouldn't go on a Saturday, for instance. So you're reminded you're not part of the norm or the mainstream.
No, but there's pre-polling now, so it's not a big problem, you know.
Sure, there are ways.
And I agree with you just for purely sentimental reasons, Judy, but I suspect it's really on the way out and we better enjoy it while it lasts.
I mean, the main advantage of it is that it makes counting much quicker. I mean, it may be that they'll introduce electronic voting inside of the polling booth, you know, which would enable the voting to be mechanised. But and also the polling booths, you know, you can apply for postal votes.
Yeah.
Like they've been very easily available. So, you know, I don't think it's a big problem.
The idea of the majority privacy ensured by walking into a a booth appeals to me a lot. You wonder so much about how something can be skewed just by people doing it in their lounge rooms with an overbearing wife or brother. I want to ask you both to sort of imagine what our election today, for example, or, you know, contemporary politics might look like if we didn't have some of these things. So compulsory voting, preferential voting, these things that ensure the voice of the maximum number of Australians is heard and counted. How do you think it might look? It's a difficult question, but...
Well, I mean, I think we'd have more conservative policies. I mean, one of the lines in the book is if we didn't have compulsory voting, we would not have Medicare, because we know that the coalition, I mean, it was dismantled, Medibank was dismantled under Fraser, Hawke brought it back, Howard never supported it, but he realised that actually it was quite popular. So I do think that it keeps some of our more egalitarian policies in place through that period of neoliberalism, which I think is now starting to come to an end. But I think we retained more than some other countries have because of that. So I think on the policy level, it would have had an impact. But I think the other thing that protects us from some of the aberrations that we see in a country like the United States is the Australian Electoral Commission, that we have our elections run by non-partisan public servants. You know, and that's... when I was doing the research of the book and looking at the way in which in the United States elections are run by party officials. So if you're a Republican running an election in an area where, you know, things are pretty close, you don't put as many polling booths into areas where Democrat voters live. You know, it was shocking. And
it was astonishing, wasn't it?
I came away thinking, I don't understand how this country can call itself a democracy, because coming up with the sort of majoritarian democratic commitments that come out of the Australian political culture, and with our really terrific tradition of this impartial administration of elections, you know, it's just shocking.
One of the ways we can think about it, though, too, is the fact that we have had a couple of instances of non-compulsory voting. So, for instance, and you write about this, Judith, the Constitutional Convention that the Howard government ran, the convention was made up of half appointed individuals and half elected. And when you were asking about the early political experience, that was my other possible answer that links into learning about the preferential system. I was part of a group of people who wanted to remind the public that, of course, women hadn't been involved in the constitutional conventions. Catherine Helen Spence, who is written about in Judith's book, was the first woman political candidate in running to be on that constitutional convention, sadly unsuccessfully. But in order to make that point, we were advocating to the government that they should ensure that there were equal numbers of women at this constitutional convention, or that in 1998. And when they didn't appoint an equal number, about a third of the makeup of the appointed were women, there were a group of us here in Melbourne who became part of a women's ticket that argued that we needed to vote for more to encourage people to vote for more women so that we would balance up so that there were equal numbers of women. And Misha Schubert, who many of you may know as a journalist, was running similarly on a youth ticket. And the women's ticket sort of collaborated with Misha in discussions and so forth. But little known to us, she was aware of the impact of the preferential system, and so went and canvassed all of the smaller groups that were campaigning to give all their preferences. And so on the voting on the day, the women's ticket got something like 20,000 votes and Misha got 5,000 votes. But once all the preferences came through, Misha got in. And it was another early example from year 10 to then being a university academic of how important it is to know how the system works. So it's not just about voting, it's about the impact of how your vote counts. And I think preferential voting is a significant aspect, of course, to the health of our democracy.
Yes, and I hadn't realised how unusual it was until, again...
Well, we're the aberration. We think about looking at somewhere like the States an aberration, but we're just positively weirdos compared to the rest of the world. But it is a bit of a... It's a strange one, because this is the other thing that comes through this story to me, is that we place, and quite rightly, I think, immense trust in our system of elections, largely because it's not the politicians that organise it, but for other reasons too, because we all partake and so on. And yet our trust in our actually the people that we elect seems to be, getting less and less. We make it easy for voters but really difficult for candidates. What, Kim, is going on there?
I think it's a legacy of our constitutional framework. There's no doubt in my mind that Section 44 really needs great attention on a number of levels. One, it's about the time of when you nominate. So whether you're going to be successful or not as a politician, you have to consider whether you give up your job as a state employee or whether you forego your formal links with another country by virtue of having another citizenship. And you may then run and not be successful and those things have gone. And so that's a huge hurdle in terms of encouraging people to be active citizenship.
It's a massive chunk, isn't it, when you think about, you're knocking out all posties, a lot of nurses, a lot of teachers, and public servants and...
academics.
I mean, I've actually come to see this as more crucial than the... dual citizenship?
Well, I think they're each equally important because of the nature of representation. Yeah. Because if you're allowing your dual citizens to vote and if it's transparent, if you changed it so that dual citizens could run for parliament, then it would be transparent and we as electors could decide whether we wanted those people to represent us and there would be some sort of register and way of being able to keep them accountable in parliament in the same way we do for a register of financial interests or other aspects. And so to require a certain group in society to forego what I think is an identity aspect as well and to treat them as lesser or more suspect by being members of parliament is really problematic. And I think it really, in some ways, it could have been heralded, all of the kerfuffle last year, as a great multicultural statement that we as a nation have encouraged these people to want to be representatives within the first or second generation of being here in Australia. That's a real sign.
Except most of them, it wasn't that, was
well,
it?
Most not
of
more, them,
it
that's
was
right. Some
British
of them were,
ancestry.
That's right. Indeed,
that was,
but New Zealand.
Yeah.
So, but on many levels, I just think it doesn't speak well to the current nature of our community.
I just cannot see in 100 years that flying though as a referendum to change that.
I'm a bit more positive. I think any referendum change is about a bipartisan approach and speaking to the interests of the community and seeing there are so many dual citizens in Australia. I just think we need strong leadership on it.
Yeah, I agree.
Great.
I've sort of thought maybe you shouldn't have to... I mean, even somebody like me is unsure. I haven't got a problem with if you're elected to the federal parliament that you should not be a dual citizen. I can see why that is in there. I can. What I can't see is that you have to give it up to try, to put your hand up. I've always thought a sort of compromise on it would be good where you give it up if you're elected. And it's sort of an act of showing that I've been elected to, but to actually put your hand up to have a go,
But it's also just the nature of the demographic shift, with a continuing active migration program, with many countries where citizenship can pass generationally. There's actually going to be a shrinking pool of people who are eligible to be elected, and that strikes me as a major political problem when we're looking at the representativeness of our parliament.
The other issue which you touched on before is women.
Yes.
And you've actually been involved in looking at ways to get more women in, and one of them is the job sharing arrangement.
Yes.
And tell us about the case. Was it in England?
In the UK, in the last election, there were two women who decided to apply to nominate to represent one seat. One of them was a woman who suffered from a particular health condition, which meant that she had to sleep for 12 or 14 hours a day, so couldn't work full time. And the other woman was a single mum with young children, and so she couldn't work full time either. And so they sought to jointly be the representative. And it raised, I think, very interesting issues that have actually gone further in the UK framework, where there's been a parliamentary inquiry to start thinking about a job share framework. And I think it's a really healthy way of starting to think about how we encourage greater diversity within our parliamentary framework, because that full-time commitment for a range of reasons diminishes your pool also of the diverse type of representative that you can have. And if you think of the way our party system works in terms of people having to agree on approaches to different policy, it would not be too difficult for two people to work out some arrangement about what their policies were and how they would negotiate that joint position. So I think it's something that we should start talking about a little bit more in thinking about more creative ways of enabling more people to think about being active citizens beyond their vote.
Do you like that idea, a job share?
I mean, I've never thought of it before.
I've thought of it since I had kids.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've never been attracted to going into Parliament, so I've never thought. I mean, partly, you know, because I haven't, I just, something I thought a lot about when I was writing the Deakin book, which is that I think the nature now of a politician's life is that you have to be a pretty relentless extrovert. You know, you're on. You know, you're up reading the paper at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you've got breakfast meetings, and I just don't have the temperament to do that. I can't stand breakfast meetings, you know. But you know, if you're a more introverted sort of person, I think that becoming a politician would be very hard. Maybe at the state level it would be possible, but I think there's actually almost like a psychological narrowing of the sorts of people who have actually got the psychological stamina or the right temperament to become politicians. I mean, I remember when Julia Gillard was Prime Minister and she's having an absolutely terrible time being battered this way and that, just thinking, I don't know how she does it. I don't know how she sleeps at night. I don't know how she can get up in the morning. I mean, I couldn't do it. So, I mean, I don't have a solution to that, but I do think it is a problem that we... That the sort of people that are being selected, and maybe that's one of the reasons why many people are feeling more disaffected with parliamentarians than they used to be.
There's an article you wrote, Kim, that yes. Where you pointed out that I think that there's never been a leader, or certainly a prime minister in Australia, that's come out of a caring profession.
That's right. So if you enabled more people from a diverse background, you would perhaps have an influence on that psychological trait.
No, you couldn't. I would go mad. I mean, somebody like me, I would go mad being a politician today. I mean, I would be in tears by the end of the first week.
It's certainly not going to be for everyone, no matter how they do the system.
Yeah, yeah.
But the system can't be right when not a single leader has ever come out of a caring... I mean, that's just astonishing to me.
And I think that's why I think Jacinda Ardern is really making that sort of impact on our consciousness about thinking about doing things differently. The fact that she has had a child in office must have an impact on the way she deals with her day compared to what you were just saying, Judith. And I think that if we started to change that frame of thinking about what is expected of a politician to enable a much more diverse life experience to be in the pool, you would have to start breaking down those narrow psychological frames.
I think it could work at the state level. I think that, that New Zealand is a much, much smaller and simpler country than Australia is. And I think the the travel demands that are on West Australian politicians, for example, and Queensland politicians. You know, I mean, I do think that's a physical problem. I mean, we're stuck with it. That's the nature of our country. But, you know, there was the, I can't remember his name now, the Labor parliamentarian from Western Australia who, after a short time in the job, said, I can't do this because it's wrecking my family. I mean, I think the other solution is for people to go in when they're a little bit older, around, you know, when they've had... That was certainly the case in the 19th century. A lot of people didn't actually go into politics till their 40s and 50s when they made a name for themselves and made some money and had their families. I mean, then we're not talking about women at that point, but...
Your point about Western Australia, though, reminds me also about the point that we made at the time of the constitutional conventions of why we needed women to be there. Because one of the comments was that you knew that no women could possibly have been at those conventions when they made the decision that the capital city had to be at least 100 miles away from Melbourne or Sydney. And that was about the struggle of power between Melbourne and Sydney. But any woman who was thinking about balancing work and family would never have had their main job at least 100 miles away, so which is the point you're making about why it might be relevant to state parliament. But I think it speaks to that broader notion that if you have more diversity within your parliamentary framework, you start to think of things differently rather than taking things that are the norm as being there forever.
Mm. Mm. I thought I understood about politics and democracy until I actually put my hand up last year to run for Lord Mayor. And even though that was at the local level, I was really struck by the overall experience of that, the things that frightened me about it, the things that I thought that I would learn. The things that frightened me were like the Herald Sun and, you know, 3AW and actually that was all totally fine. It was totally fine. What I came out of it feeling really bruised about were a few things that I learned about the laws around it and the lack of democracy in it. There were two things in particular. One of them applies to all elections except in Tasmania, and that is the ballot draw. And you sort of know it's unfair, but there's a bit of an Australian thing of, oh, well, you know, that's the draw, like a horse race. But actually, when you're in it and there are two Sallys and you're second on that list, it is crushing. And you just sort of, you know, and it is actually really quite unfair. There's just a different way that people look at the top of the list to the bottom of the list.
Yes.
And in Tasmania, it's the Robson rotation.
They randomly print the ballot papers so the names get
muddled up.
Yes, there was one idea was that they have a circular ballot paper, but I think that was somebody. I think it was a Tasmanian's idea, but that didn't go anywhere. But and I think the ACT uses the Robson rotation as well, and that would certainly, I think that's right, I think that is something that could be adopted.
I mean, it's just fair, right, and it was really glaring because the candidate that got the top spot, which is the one everyone wants, you know, she got 5,000 votes, I think, and she didn't exist. Like, she was somebody who paid the money as a candidate.
So was she a dummy?
We don't, nobody knows to this day, nobody knows who she was. Mm. And she picked up 5,000, she didn't turn up to a single debate, didn't do any advertising material, no profile, web page, nothing. Wow. App didn't do any, she was like a mystery. We all called her the mystery. And, you know, so the other one is that in local councils, this idea that some groups can have more than one vote.
Yeah.
So how do these things remain in our system?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, voting rights used to be attached to property rather than people. And so the local council has still got voting rights attached to property. In Australia, we got rid of it at the assembly level, very early. It still hung around, the idea of plural voting, that if you owned a property in a couple of different electorates, you got a vote in each of the electorates that you own property in. But that's what local council still has, the vote attached to you being a rate paper and to property.
which is where your example of permanent residents actually having a right to vote if they've got property. So citizenship is not your criteria for local council voting. So we do have a broader franchise there, but obviously
or
not.
Broader and narrower.
Yes.
Because if you're a permanent resident who
doesn't... Without money, that's right.
Yeah.
So how do you change these things, given how really hard we know it is in Australia... to whether it's section, you know, 41, 44, yep. these issues we've been talking about.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, after the total debacle over the citizenship stuff, I mean, I felt really critical of the High Court, I have to say, because it was making the Constitution more important than the democratic will of the people that had been expressed in the vote. And I thought it was interesting that all those people got re-elected. I felt, you know, I felt it was... You know, I just thought it was the High Court made the wrong decision, I have to say. So I think that if we had have had a functioning government at that point, we might have been able to... There was a sort of momentum, and I think... I agree with Kim. I think that if we hopefully one sometime we'll get a functioning government, that there could be bipartisan agreement on that. It doesn't seem to me to be something that there's a party... that you can see a party wedge forming?
There was not a word of eloquence in that whole time of the citizenship crisis. I don't remember a single speech or press conference.
Well, I think it came out of the blue. I think people were surprised. I mean, it was that... Wasn't that guy in West Australia, somebody without a life?
Who was
a lawyer. It was a solicitor, yeah.
Yeah. And it sort of sideswiped everybody. And so they were all floundering, and I don't think they had time to really think it through.
I think on the High Court level, I think the first judgment is an understandable judgment because it was not a new issue. I mean, in 1983, Phil Cleary's case raised it fairly and squarely, and the whole question of being a citizen of another country was right there because some of the other candidates at the time, there was a Greek national and a Swiss national who had actually sworn in the earlier part of the citizenship ceremony, you used to actually make a statement, I renounce all former citizenships, and those two individuals thought that was sufficient to them then be eligible to run. But the High Court acknowledged an important international law feature, which is that it's all very well for an individual to say that, but if the laws of that country still recognise you as a citizen. And the High Court decision in Canavan followed that. I personally think that the decision in the Katie Gallagher case is actually much more problematic because what they decided there was even at the time of nomination, if you have done everything that you can possibly do yourself, but that other country takes however long it wants to take to process your application, then you are precluded from running. And so that is actually giving another country power over who runs for an election. So if you're worried about foreign interference, that is a very clear constitutional expression of that, which is, I think, very concerning.
And how many candidates just this week have been lost?
That they can't run because they can't confirm that they don't have another citizenship.
You would have thought that would have been sorted, wouldn't you? Yeah. If you'd like to ask a question, please just put your hand up and start talking if a microphone lands in it.
Yeah, good evening. I think it was John Howard who said you change the government, you change the country. And I don't think we recognise enough if you change the voting system, you change the country. And you use some overseas examples and they've definitely impacted how those countries have developed. And certainly in a state level, I see creeping changes to voting systems without real debate, like four-year terms, optional preferential. And I'm not sure at the federal level how many of the aspects of our voting are actually in the Constitution and require a referendum or could actually happen through parliamentary action. So I'm interested in that topic.
None of it's, or very little of it's in the Constitution. It's in legislation. So it's, you know, the parliaments frame the electoral laws.
That's one of the... So some of the provisions of the Constitution say until the Parliament otherwise provides, and in relation to voting, that is the case. And that was one of the recommendations to change Section 44, just to change and say until Parliament otherwise provides, and then that would have been a very clear way of enabling your democratic body to then determine what are the rules for standing. Would have been, and that's what the electoral the Standing Committee actually recommended. But again, neither party has gone with it. Mm.
It was Keating, by the way, that said if you change the in desperation in 96, I'm pretty sure.
Hi. During the unnecessary optional postal poll on marriage, there was a lot of fear that because that was voluntary, people wouldn't bother to vote, and that whatever side won, there wouldn't be the democratic mandate for changing or not changing the Act if it was less than a majority. And it did turn out to be astonishingly and amazingly a majority of voters voting for yes. Was that, do you think, because we're so used to compulsory voting that people just, when given the chance to vote, automatically do it? Or do you think that was because of the particular issue and the really vibrant get out the vote campaigns?
Great question.
I think it was both. I think, you know, we know that one of the big advantages of compulsory voting is that people learn how to vote because they have to. It's not something, you know, that's voluntary and then maybe, you know, I think it's that, but also the fact that there was a big campaign to get people on the electoral roll. And Sally, we were talking about this just before, you know, coming into this election, it's the biggest electoral roll ever. And that's partly because with the same-sex marriage survey, a huge effort was made by activists to get young people onto the electoral roll. And now they're compelled to vote.
Almost 60,000 young people alone got on the roll. Mm. Many of them might not have.
Yes, I think it's a reminder, though, also of how a campaign or an attention to the very specific issue at play is so fundamental to enlivening people's interests. So that I'm not sure what the comparisons were, say, for instance, at the Constitutional Convention, free voting or, you know, non-compulsory voting.
Very low turnout.
That was so. Yeah. So that's another example. We know how to vote, but people didn't bother. What will be also interesting is Labor have promised to hold a plebiscite in relation to a republic, and that turnout will also be quite interesting because that's a plebiscite, not yet a referendum, to see what the overall mood of the country is in a similar way that they had with the same-sex marriage. And so that would also be interesting to compare in terms of the turnout for that sort of plebiscite.
The really high turnout for that worried me, actually, as somebody that's so pro-compulsory voting, that it would be used by people that are against compulsory voting to say, but look, you know, so many people turned up and...
Yeah, but see, there is a section of the Liberal Party that is always arguing that we should have voluntary voting, and they do point to that. They say, look, everybody votes anyway, so we don't need the law. But the point about that is it's the formation of the habit. It's the role of compulsory voting in socialising people, in teaching them about politics. So I taught, you know, first years for years, and when I asked them why they were doing the subject, a lot of them would say, well, we have to vote, so we need to know a bit about politics. That is, it actually was an encouragement to engagement. And even if the first couple of votes they made were foolish votes or ignorant votes, by the time people are 30, or, you know, they've been through a number of election campaigns and they will have started to pick up some political knowledge. And so I think that argument is, you know, we're looking at an electorate which actually already has the habit.
And funnily enough, survey after survey shows that if Australians were forced to go and vote about whether they should be forced to vote, they would overwhelmingly every time say yes.
That's right. Because
I just love that. I love that about our country.
Yeah, because Howard, there was Nick Minchin and Erica Betts were on the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters, and they put in a recommendation to get rid of compulsory voting. And Howard said, look, I agree with you, I support voluntary voting. However, the Australian people support compulsory voting, and he made a decision that he wasn't going to, you know, waste political capital on this.
It just reminds me, talking about compulsory voting and civic education, when the Rudd government came into power and decided it would review the citizenship test that had been introduced by the Howard government, I was one of the members of the independent committee that reviewed the test. And when we had our first meeting with Chris Evans before we started the review, I rather facetiously said to him, is it open for us to offer this test to every Australian citizen, given that everyone has to vote? And I thought it was a way of saying to him, what are the standards that we're putting on new citizens compared to our expectations of our own citizens? And I think it's a rather sobering question about inclusion and exclusion around citizenship.
Hi. I'm a dual citizen myself and eligible to vote both in Australia and New Zealand. So having experience of both systems, I've often had arguments with my wife over compulsory voting, and I was always against compulsory voting. She was a big fan of it. She's Australian. One of the arguments that I always tried to make was that I thought it, obviously turnout is a huge, has a huge impact on elections. But one of the arguments that I always thought was important was that you see relatively high turnouts in countries like New Zealand. And I think that could be partly attributable to the voting system, that they have mixed member proportional, a proportional voting system. I think people get out and vote when they feel like their vote matters. And if you, whether or not you have compulsory voting, if you feel like your vote doesn't matter because you live in a safe seat and it doesn't matter who you vote for, it's not going to make any difference, then you're relatively disengaged from the political system. But in a system like they have in New Zealand, where no matter if you're in a safe seat, you can cast a party vote that will have an impact on who gets into parliament, then you're more engaged with the political system. And I wondered what you thought about that.
I think that's actually quite a very perceptive point. I mean, it would mean that we would get out because our Senate vote will count, where, you know, it is degree of proportional system. That, I mean, I think that multi-member electorates are quite a good idea, but I can't see, in a way, the Hare Clark system in Tasmania is like that, but I can't see that the Australian electoral system changing away from single member electorates for the House of Reps.
It's interesting you say that you can vote in both places, and it may have changed, but my understanding in New Zealand was it was more about residence than about citizenship, so that as a citizen who's been outside of the country for a particular period, they get struck off the electoral roll, whether you go back regularly enough to be able to stay on the electoral roll. But it is quite an interesting question about voting. Well, that's right. In the Australian framework, you have to have an intention to be returning within a certain period of time to be eligible to stay on the electoral roll if you're outside it. And there's a group of Australian expatriates who have been for years trying to change that, because even though they're not intending to come back to Australia, they are very connected. So, you know, it's a really interesting question about residence and voting, because you could be living overseas and doing things that benefit Australia but not really intending to come back and live in Australia. And with a globalised world, our connections to nation states are not just by residing in them. We can actually stay involved in different ways. And so I think it complicates our thinking about residence and citizenship and voting.
It's a massive exercise, what's going to go on the 18th of May. Remarkable. And Judy, these figures are in the book, so you don't have to write them down, but they're fantastic. There's going to be 7,000 polling places, 120,000 booths, And a wonderful story about at the beginning of compulsory voting, they only had one booth until someone figured out we could speed this up if we just put a few in.
That's an Australian invention, the polling booth?
Yep.
We can all be proud of that, like the Hills Hoist.
And also the great Australian tradition of the pencil, which now requires 140 kilometres of string to stop them being stolen. But the pencil was also to speed things up because they had to use to dip the pen originally. So these exercises in great Australian bureaucratic kind of traditions.
We're practical people.
We really are. 75,000 polling clerks. You know, but, I mean, the amount of work that, and of course, we just have to turn up and get in a queue. And honestly, I love it. I've said this before. I pick the day, the time of the day where I think the queue will be longest. Oh. I enjoy it so much. So before I thank you. How do you like your democracy sausage, Judy?
Well, I don't actually like sausages very much.
No, you don't have one? You buy a cake at the primary school
store?
Yeah,
maybe a coffee, yeah.
Yeah. Kim?
I'm a vegetarian soul, or if I was eating a sausage, it would be a kosher sausage, so it doesn't really work
good
for me either.
Grief. Okay.
The websites that are up there now will tell you where
you
can get vegan
one.
Sausages and kosher sausages and all that sort of thing. That's what a democracy sausage is. It's the sausage mediated by social media.
Oh, my goodness. Look, once every 3 years, I'm happy to have a non-kosher sausage with onions, mustard and tomato sauce, I've got to say. It's been such a pleasure, such an insight, I'm sure, for everyone. Judy's book, From Secret Ballot to Democracy Sausage, it's on sale down the back. You've got time to read it before Election Day, which would just make it delicious timing. Thank you all for being such a fantastic audience tonight. Please thank our wonderful, wonderful guests, Kim and Judy. Thank you so much.
Judith Brett, Kim Rubenstein and Sally Warhaft, live at the Wheeler Centre on Tuesday, April 16th, 2019. If you're interested in some lesser-known stories about voting, visit wheelercentre.com and search for Housekeeping, a super interesting mini-series by Jani Blakali. It's available to read or as a five-part podcast feature, and it covers some of the issues discussed in this episode, like voter ID, electronic voting, and of course, the democracy sausage. That's Housekeeping at wheelercentre.com. The Fifth Estate is back in 2 weeks with Jill Abramson, former executive editor of the New York Times. If you'd like to see the conversation live in Melbourne, tickets are available at our website. Until then, take care.